The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Back on Iran. Did you warn Prime Minister Netanyahu against taking some sort of actions that could disrupt the talks there in a phone call last week?
Well, I'd like to be honest. Yes, I did. Next question, please.
Mr. President, I'll jump on sanctions.
I did, yeah.
If Senate Republicans want to push
it's
forward.
Not a warning. I said I don't think it's appropriate.
What exactly did you tell him?
I don't think it's appropriate. We're having very good discussions with him, and I said I don't think it's appropriate right now. Because if we can settle it with a very strong document, very strong, with inspections and no trust. I don't trust anybody. So no trust. I want it very strong where we can go in with inspectors.
There was a time when quite a few commentators said that it's the Jews, it's Israel that's driving America's foreign policy. You certainly can't say that about this particular administration, Donald Trump's administration, I mean. Here he is on the phone with Prime Minister Netanyahu saying, do not strike Iran. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. You can get to the live video of this program at TrumpetDaily.com or at the Rumble channel, Rumble.com/TrumpetDaily. A lot to get to on today's show, including the third part of our three-part series, our interview with Melanie Phillips earlier this week. And as I was just saying to our producer, what a perfect time. Perfect timing, really, to sit down and talk with her. And you hear, if you've watched the last two shows, you see some strong, she talked about, Israel being so excited and relieved even when Donald Trump was reelected in November. But now what must they be thinking? Now you've got Witkoff, this was in the morning brief today, you've got Witkoff basically putting pressure on Israel to release Palestinian hostages, people that have gotten life sentences for their crimes against Jews, so many of them. Anything for a ceasefire. And then, as Donald Trump said, at least he was honest. Well, I want to be honest. Yeah, I did get on the phone and I told Bibi not to lash out at Iran, because we're going to get a strong document. We're going to solve this with dialogue. The pace with which these events are unfolding. Axios has a story. Gulf leaders told Trump they oppose strikes on Iran's nuclear program. This is just from Axios today. So you heard there Donald Trump saying to reporters, yeah, I told Bibi what Gulf leaders told me to tell him. That's essentially what this amounts to. So Donald Trump, he goes on this trip, he visits with the Saudis, with the Emirates, with the Qataris, and they all say no Israeli strike on Iran. And then, as you just heard there, Donald Trump says, I passed along the message to Bibi. Who is running the show here? Who's in charge of U.S. foreign policy? We've talked at length about the trillions of dollars that the Trump administration has been bragging about coming in from Qatar, from UAE, from Saudi Arabia, even Air Force One, brought to you by Qatar. And then the phone call with Bibi. Hey, don't you do anything. Don't you target Iran's nuclear facilities, because we've got an agreement. We're making good progress with dialogue. This is shocking to see this unfold the way that it is, particularly after the first term of Donald Trump. And here again, Melanie Phillips and others have talked about this split in the MAGA movement, even in the West Wing of the White House, where you've got, you know, a healthy number of people that are, you know, basically applying pressure on Donald Trump to abandon the Jews, that are saying that Israel is the problem in the Middle East. Melanie Phillips, that last installment, by the way, we tie things up there at the end, and I even asked her about Celtic Throne. We've got I haven't talked enough about this. There's just been so much going on in the news since our graduation a week and a half ago, AC graduation. But there at the end of the interview, you'll see it in the final segment today, I invited her to Celtic Throne in Israel because the the performance, the show's going international in just a couple weeks' time. And so hopefully she can turn out. Hopefully some other, you know, prominent Israeli figures can turn out for one of those five shows. Two in Tel Aviv, one in Jerusalem, one in Beersheba, one in Haifa. All over the country. And we're going to be selling out a couple of these venues at least. That comes at a good time. Melanie Phillips' interview comes at a good time. We've got feedback from the show in Colorado Springs the other night. And if we have time later, we can get through to that as well. If not, we'll play it on tomorrow's show. But this is from the Morning Brief. Joel Hilliker says here, another lopsided hostage deal. Steve Witkoff, Donald Trump's special envoy to the Middle East, released a new ceasefire proposal for Israel and Hamas yesterday. The proposal would halt fighting for 60 days. On what terms? Israel receives 10 living hostages and 18 dead bodies in exchange for releasing 125 Palestinian prisoners serving life sentences. These people weren't kidnapped. You know, innocent civilians kidnapped by Israel. These are terrorists. In prison, 125 of them released, and then 1,100 Gazan detainees arrested after October 7, and then the bodies of 180 Gazans, brought to you by Steve Witkoff. I mean, could it be more lopsided than this? After weeks of stonewalling, Hamas is interested. Well, why wouldn't they be? This is a perfect deal. As Melanie Phillips brought out, we played the clip again yesterday. I mean, they went in and kidnapped civilians, innocent civilians, on October 7 because they knew that the hostages would secure their survival as a terrorist organization. And here's where we are. As I say, brought to you by Steve Witkoff. The Trumpet Brief says, this is fascinating. Israel had recently begun distributing aid to Gazans outside. Well, the point of it is Hamas is feeling pressure now because the humanitarian aid that was just flowing into Gaza. I mean, who does this if they're trying to carry out a genocide? The flow of humanitarian aid, it was going through Hamas, but Hamas would then seize control of all this humanitarian aid, including lots of food, and basically steal it for themselves, for their terrorist organization. And then they'd sell it to normal Gazan civilians at exorbitant prices. And this racket is how they recruited new soldiers to kill Jews, because a lot of the Hamas fighters have been killed by the Israeli counteroffensive. So Netanyahu, he got, I think, some of the third party and redirected the aid to this group so that they're in control of it in Gaza, and it's cut off Hamas's lifeline, basically. So now they're interested in another deal brought to you by Steve Witkoff, brought to you by America. It says here, the Trump administration sees this as a deal-making opportunity. Israel was on the verge of defeating Hamas when the U.S. pushed its first ceasefire deal in January. Back then, Gerald Fleury said that President Trump betrayed Israel. You heard it here first. You heard it here in the first few days of this administration. Now see where we are. Did you call Bibi and pressure him not to strike Iran? Well, yeah, I did. I absolutely did. We're doing a deal with the mullahs. We're doing a deal with the supreme leader. Mark Levin tweeted out, why is the United States dictating to Israel how to fight Hamas? He said, why do we have an envoy negotiating with Hamas and working with Qatar and telling the Israelis what to do with Hamas when Hamas attacked Israel, slaughtered their people, and Hamas is holding their people hostage? What's going on here? And Iran, for its part, they want to obliterate Israel from off the map. And in that case, you've got the U.S. special envoy talking to the mullahs and then telling Israel to back off. It's unbelievable. We keep demanding a ceasefire, which is what the Biden regime did. There's really no difference here. I mean, they've got different motivations, Donald Trump and the dear leader. But there's, as far as just for practical purposes of the course of action that we're choosing on, it's about the same. Why are we not allowing Israel to handle this instead of prolonging the war? As for the hostages, the Israelis want them back as urgently as we do, indeed more so, but they have to decide the best way forward. The Israelis have all but destroyed Hezbollah. They're destroying Hamas. They've destroyed Iran's air defenses and much of its economy. Israel knows what to do and how to do it. So here's Mark Levin, an American Jew, a conservative, saying, why are we meddling in this in the first place? And really, he's putting it nicely. Because you have America putting pressure on Israel not to defend itself. What a difficult position to be put into. There's so much that's happening so fast. This was brought out in the news from one of our news gatherers. This article my father wrote back in January of 2022. And he was just talking in that article about, you know, the pace of world events. My father says, I think this is from 2022. I wish I could work for an administration that could move that quickly. This is what one of Biden administration veteran admitted to Axios during the U.S. President Donald Trump's recent norm-shattering trip to the Middle East. So no, this was more recent. This is the latest trumpet. Sorry. Tomorrow's news today. If you don't have a trumpet subscription, make sure that you call our operators and request a free 1 year subscription. But it says here, love him or hate him, the president certainly is moving quickly. Even his enemies are impressed with his boldness. Some of these moves were positive and necessary. Some are having their intended effect. President Trump is working to rebuild America's strength and stature and to cement his own legacy as a peacemaker. But he does not realize that his decisions have far-reaching, unforeseen ripple effects. In fact, they are propelling major end-time biblical prophecies toward their fulfillment. The Melanie Phillips interview comes at the perfect time. And then the latest issue of The Trumpet. Perfect timing, yet again. God is informing us. God is educating us. And hopefully we're eager students of Bible prophecy, because a lot of it's being fulfilled. Says we, in fact, they are propelling major end-time biblical prophecies toward their fulfillment. World events. The Trumpet and our predecessor, The Plain Truth, have warned about for decades, based on biblical prophecy, are accelerating faster than ever. Faster than ever before. There's another article here from 1945 talking about Putin and just delving into Putin's thinking with respect to Ukraine. I mean, all these reports of late saying he wants the whole of it. He wants all of it now. And this was something that, as you know, Donald Trump said, hey, when I get in there, it's over in 24 hours. And we're seeing with Hamas, Qatar, Iran, we're seeing the mindset behind these kinds of negotiations. Just appease the enemy, appease the aggressor, so that we can just get a ceasefire or hostages returned. Do anything. You've heard it from Witkoff, how that dialogue can solve everything. Well, amid the fast pace of all these events and even the fast pace of the Trump administration, you're also seeing that a lot of dialogue doesn't necessarily solve the problems of this world. And in some cases, it's making it much worse. He promised to end the bloodshed in Ukraine in 24 hours. It says, predictably, the trials and tribulations of American diplomacy since the new administration took office have shown that reaching a workable and enduring cessation of hostilities between Russia and Ukraine was always a bridge too far. And then it goes on and explains why. The reason for this has yet to register with the Trump administration fully. Russia is simply not interested in any outcome in Ukraine short of achieving the primary policy objectives that drove it to invade the country again in 2022 in the first place. So this article does a good job of getting to root causes. Why did Putin attack Ukraine in the first place? It seems like going into a negotiation would require that you at least delve into that recent history. And even the history before that. You heard it at the trumpet. You heard it decades ago that the goal of Putin is to rebuild an empire. It says here, the fact that the U.S. administration continues to negotiate the Ukraine ceasefire shows that Washington also doesn't fully understand the very nature of the Russian state, the drivers of Putin's policy. And most of all, that Moscow believes it can continue to pursue the war and achieve its objectives at an acceptable cost to the regime. It's worth it for him to continue firing missiles on civilians. From the start, again, you would have heard this in the trumpet many years ago. From the start, for Vladimir Putin and his inner circle in the Kremlin, this has been a war for the restoration of the Russian Empire. That's what's motivating him. That's what's driving him. And then if you switch over to the Middle East, you think, well, what is driving Hamas? What's motivating them? What about their mindset? What about Iran, the mullahs? What about Qatar, UAE, Saudi Arabia? To just think you can sit down and talk sense into these people, terrorists. Again, it shows a total trust in human nature. And it also reveals total ignorance with respect to human nature. In this case, I mean, what was driving Putin from the beginning? It says here, these were his objectives. First, to restore the Eastern Slavic inner core of the imperial state by subjecting Belarus, then Ukraine, and in effect, reincorporate both into the Russian sphere. And then second, his simultaneous objective is to undermine and ultimately fracture NATO. And then his third objective is to get America out. So he's accomplishing these things. And up until what, Monday? Or over the weekend? Donald Trump was talking about Putin as a nice gentleman. Yeah, you want to hear about my phone call with the nice gentleman in the Kremlin? I wonder how that phone call, if you were to look at a transcript of both, I wonder how that one would compare with the one he made to Bibi. Don't you attack Iran. We're making progress. And then yesterday, Witkoff. Now we've got a ceasefire in place, 60 days. And you'll get back 10 of those hostages. And you've got to give thousands of Palestinians back. That's the way it works. We've got to appease the terrorists. As I say, shocking. You expect it under the Dear Leaders regime. You expect it with the fake president. This, unless you understand Bible prophecy, though, this is totally unexpected. But look, we know from Bible prophecy that the brotherhood bond, it's to unravel in these last days. And Israel's going to be looking to Assyria in the heart of Europe for help, for support. It says here, it's high time the West acknowledges that Russia has been waging a war of imperial reconquest. You could have written or read that in the trumpet 5, 10, 15 years ago. All of these prophecies, they're just speeding up. And then here at home, right here in America, you've got the big, beautiful bill and people just, you know, congratulating themselves. And here it increases spending after all that Doge uncovered. And then, well, right on cue, right? Elon Musk, he criticizes the big, beautiful bill. And then next thing you know, last night, it's announced that he's leaving Doge. You can't criticize this administration. I mean, if you do, you are on the outside looking in. You go to the outer court. All of this fraud, this waste, just pure theft even. It's all revealed, and yet there's no reduction whatsoever in spending. Play this montage that just kind of sums up some of what we've seen in the news the last couple days. Clip one.
Elon Musk's time at Doge is coming to an end, starting tonight. Musk just announced, as my scheduled time as a special government employee comes to an end, I would like to thank President Trump for the opportunity to reduce wasteful spending. The Doge mission will only strengthen over time as it becomes a way of life throughout the government.
He's finally met his match, and it's the federal government. And he goes into the federal government and did an honorable job of cutting spending, but politicians can't keep their hands off of our money.
No.
At the end of the day.
Mr. President, Elon Musk in a television interview criticized the one big, beautiful bill, saying he was disappointed it didn't cut enough, essentially, that it undercut the Doge efforts. What's your reaction to that?
Well, the reaction's a lot of things. Number one, we have to get a lot of votes. We can't be cutting. You know, we need to get a lot of support, and we have a lot of support. We had to get it through the House. The House was, we have no Democrats. You know, if it's up to the Democrats, they'll take the 65% increase. You know, if that doesn't get approved, this country is going to have a 65% increase in taxes and lots of other problems, big problems, almost bigger than that. But we'll have a 65% increase as opposed to the largest tax cut in the history of our country. We will be negotiating that bill, and I'm not happy about certain aspects of it, but I'm thrilled by other aspects of it. That's the way that goes.
The fact that in 2019 we spent $4.4 trillion, this year we'll spend over $7 trillion. You know, $150 billion on that is basically a rounding error.
Yeah, you're talking
so
about
we need
spending
to get serious
cuts.
About this. We need to establish goals. Listen, this is the weekend we honor the service and sacrifice of the finest among us. You know, more than a million that died to defend this nation. I don't think they served and sacrificed to leave our children completely mortgaged, their future and their prospects diminished because of it. So we need to be responsible. The first goal of our budget reconciliation process should be to reduce the deficit. This actually increases it. But let me describe the mess. President Obama averaged about $910 billion of deficits per year. President Trump in his first 3 years averaged about $810. Then COVID hit, over $3 trillion in deficit. It should have ended there. We should have immediately returned to a pre-pandemic level spending, but President Biden averaged $1.9 trillion of deficits over his 4 years. And according to CBO, those deficits now average $2.2 trillion over the next 10 years. We'll add $22 trillion. And I'm sorry, the House bill would probably add, I've calculated $4 trillion. You're saying you have these independent analysts saying it's $3.3 to $4 trillion. I agree with that. Mm. We have to reduce the deficit. And so we need to focus on spending, spending, spending.
So what
you don't defeat the deep state by funding it.
As the one commentator said, Elon Musk, he's finally met his match. The federal government. Politicians that are addicted to spending like they're addicted to a hard drug. They cannot reduce spending. It just keeps going up. I mean, this is like twice the Obama levels. $1.9 trillion deficit spending under Biden. Now we're up to $2.2 trillion. Is this possible? Was all of that, you know, Elon Musk Doge thing, was that just a big joke? It really is pretty sad and pathetic. That man's office, Senator Johnson there, he put out a montage about all of these Republicans. These are all recent statements. This was campaigned on. The Trump people campaigned on this, not just reducing it by $150 billion, which, as he said, there's like just a little rounding error. It's like cutting a penny out of overspending $100. It's trillions and trillions added to the deficit when the promises were to balance it. When you balance it, that means you spend what you take in. Not anymore. You balance the budget, and there were promises made, promises after promises after promises. And Senator Johnson brought the receipts. This is clip two.
I want to do what has not been done in 24 years, balance the federal budget. We're going to balance it.
We have to cut spending.
We don't have a revenue problem in this country. Revenues are up. In fact, they're up at historic levels. What we have is a spending problem.
Reduce the size and scope of government, make it work more efficiently and effectively for the American people.
He wants to balance the budget. I know I do, too.
We do not have a revenue problem in the United States of America. We have a spending problem.
What is driving inflation is the growth in federal spending.
You never have the affordability conversation at all.
There's so much to cut, and it has to happen. The national debt is so high.
We haven't had any spending reductions in like 20 years.
We should put the country back on a pathway to fiscal sanity.
Unless this exercise is successful, the ship of America will sink.
The main metric with regard to whether your fiscal house is good or not is the extent to what you're spending.
And so it went way up under COVID. And then what happened was that became basically the new baseline.
Our fiscal house continues to be a mess.
I just don't want America to go bankrupt.
The U.S. does not have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem.
Reducing the reckless levels of spending.
We've got to start bending the spending curve in the right direction.
If we didn't do something about this, then there won't be any money for anything.
We're going to look at how much we're spending. We're going to compare it against how much we should be spending. And we're going to actually rationalize and make sense of the federal budget.
I want to do what has not been done in 24 years. Balance the federal budget. We're going to balance it.
And those are all the architects of the big, beautiful bill. It's not beautiful. It's very ugly. It's in some ways, it's criminal. What so many of these people just continue to get away with. All of this fraud and waste exposed. And what do we get in the end? An increase in spending. Spending more. More deficit spending. And then we'll just call it beautiful. Well, just say it's beautiful. Listen to this from Maria Bartiromo's show, clip three.
President Trump's big, beautiful bill hitting more snags in the Senate. I spoke with Florida Senator Rick Scott in the last hour, who says he is a no vote in its current form. Watch.
I support President Trump's agenda, secure the border, build up the military, make the tax cuts permanent. And I think we've got to do all these things. Let's live in reality for a second. We're running $2 trillion deficits. If we follow the path of the House bill, we'll have close to, I think, $60 trillion worth of debt in 10 years.
$60 trillion in debt in 10 years? How is this possible? You look at some of these verses we've read through before. Psalm 37, verse 21, the wicked borrows and cannot pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives. That means there's a lot of wickedness. A lot of wickedness. The wicked borrows and can't pay it back. Never mind paying it back. Who cares about paying it back? Democrats, Republicans? You mean Republicans get control and this is what we get? A big, ugly bill? Bigger than anything in history? former U.S. Senator Tom Coburn. He said years ago about America's massive debt that history says we're not going to make it. You can't survive this. Not forever. Maybe it'll be a very, very short-term resurgence. A year, 2 years maybe, but to go from, what, $37 trillion in debt to $60 trillion in 10 years? If time were to go on long enough and Christ didn't return in the next few years or whenever, where would we be, America, 10 years from now? The borrower is a servant or a slave to the lender. History teaches you that. Neil Ferguson, the historian in the UK, said, fiscally and other ways, America is very near the edge of chaos. I think this is a problem that is going to go live really soon. He wrote that years ago in a book. Where is it leading, this way of get, this way of take? This is the way of the devil. This isn't, speaking of mindsets, speaking of root causes, who's the author of this kind of thinking? And there's only a few, outspoken critics that have the courage enough to speak out, like you just heard there from Senator Scott and then obviously Senator Johnson, but we'll see how much pressure is put upon them to comply. To just go, okay, there's a few things we don't like in it, but there's a lot that I love about it. It's beautiful. It's going to hurt America in the long run, probably in the short run, too. That's all we have time for today because we want to squeeze in the final installment of our interview with Melanie Phillips earlier in the week. So we'll segue from this right into Melanie Phillips, and that'll be your conclusion to today's show. From your book, it says, it has often been said that the Jews are the canary in the coal mine. A society that turns on the Jews is a society in deep trouble. And then you say the reaction to the October 7 onslaught showed just how much trouble the West is in. It revealed a culture in an advanced state of decay and disintegration. And then I think it's a little bit later on, you mentioned how, and we made the same point, I think October 7 was on a Saturday, and we made this point on the show, I believe Monday, that the sympathy for the Jews would last for a few hours, and then the onslaught would, as you put it, what then erupted was a tsunami of brazen, frenzied Israel hatred and anti-Semitism. Were Israelis, they were seeing this on international news outlets and so on, were they just stunned and shocked that the world reaction after October 7 would be the way that it was, with people taking to the streets in the UK and in New York and all across America in support of Hamas?
They behave as any sane person would behave. They are absolutely stunned and shocked.
Yeah.
They can't really believe it. Unless you come and live in Israel, or you take unless you come and live in Britain or America, you take the temperature of what's going on in Britain and America and other European countries. It's impossible for any normal person to grasp the derangement that has taken hold of so many in the West. If you're an Israeli, you know, you're facing this terrible situation of a genocidal enemy that says, in terms, we're going to destroy you. An enemy which has perpetrated the most savage and depraved atrocities against the Jewish people since the Holocaust. And this in a society, as you may know, it's a very small country, 10 million people. There's not a household that's not somehow affected by this. They've had people who have been murdered or taken hostage, or they know people who are those families. They have children, grandchildren, the grandchildren, children of friends or relatives who are serving in Gaza. They've served in Lebanon. A lot of them have died. A lot of them have come back alive, but missing limbs. the trauma of the families involved is indescribable. And they're looking at the outside world and they're thinking, how can any civilized human being not see this and not understand that we are the victims here and that we need to be supported?
Right.
How can any civilized country be permitting these demonstrations on campus, on the streets, week after week for 19 months, in which they are supporting genocidal mass murder on the basis that this is somehow an expression of liberal, progressive compassion? People in Israel cannot understand it. It is completely impossible to understand, except to say that the West has basically lost its mind. It's lost its conscience. It's lost its rationality, its reason. It's lost its sense of justice, its sense of right and wrong. And what I say in the book is that it's not surprising that it's that that's the reaction, because that is exactly what the West has done to itself over these decades. It's destroyed its conscience. It's destroyed its sense of justice, its sense of right and wrong. There's no such thing as truth. Everything's a matter of opinion. And it's destroyed its rationality. You cannot bring evidence to bear. You cannot say, look at what's happening in Gaza. Look at the fact that, you know, all these thousands of tons of aid have poured in and have been stolen by Hamas. You can't say the evidence is absolutely unequivocal that Israel is always trying to save life. The evidence is unequivocal that the Jews are the rightful and indigenous people of the land, that they inherited it, that they are the people, the only people, who have a legal and historical right to the land. You can bring fact after fact to adduce all these, to back up all these arguments. It goes nowhere, because we're living in a society in the West where evidence and facts no longer have any traction. We're told, this is just your opinion, and you are partisan. So we dismiss your opinion. We prefer our opinion, because it makes us feel good, because we can pretend to ourselves that we are supporting the oppressed of the earth. That's what we're up against. So in Israel, you know, every day they are coping with this trauma, this collective trauma. And I have to say, in addition, I mean, it's an amazing thing, as you may know, in Israel, side by side with this trauma and grief that are off the scale is an optimism and a determination and a certainty that Israel is going to survive this, whatever horrors still lie in store, and an amazing happiness among the people, which are astounding. You wouldn't find that anywhere else. It is simply astounding how these things all exist together, the trauma and the optimism. But they're looking at the world, at the West, and thinking, well, you know, I mean, it's just impossible to understand.
Yeah. The Washington Post, you may have seen this, I think it's from last Friday. It said Hamas's attack on Israel, October 7, 2023, and Israel's subsequent attacks on Gaza, followed by divisions around the world over what caused the conflict and who was at fault. So here's the Washington Post, and I bring this up because I know Israel, little Israel, has had pretty deep political divisions as well, and there's
of course,
plenty of
yes, absolutely,
you know, left-wing outlets over there as well. But what you just kind of talked about the resolve of the Israeli people and how that they're prepared, it seems, to go it alone if they have to, and to survive this conflict and to utterly, you know, destroy the Hamas network. But what has been the Israeli, you know, media? What have they been like following October 7? And do you have that sort of commentary still that's coming out of some of the left-wing news outlets?
Oh, it's just terrible. I mean, the Israeli media is pretty terrible. I mean, I don't have good enough Hebrew to read it and to follow it, but I get the general gist.
Yeah.
And it's just leftist mainly. They're very anti-Netanyahu. Everything is projected through the prism of that. And it's just like, you know, the people who can't see anything beyond their hatred of President Trump. It distorts how they see the world, how they see facts, unfolding before them. They can't see certain facts if it gets in the way of that narrative, hatred of President Trump. Similarly with Prime Minister Netanyahu. When you don't have to be a fan of Netanyahu to see that there is something profoundly dysfunctional about the way in which the media approach him and approach the war and the challenges facing Israel. So yes, it is very distorted. Look, I mean, you talk about divisions; they are profound. They are very damaging. The Jews are the most quarrelsome people on earth, and always have been. And there is no way in which Israel will ever be anything other than quarrelsome. There is a very significant number of Israelis who are, they were demonstrating against a judicial reform program in the 2 years before October 7. It was actually a kind of proxy for their hatred of Netanyahu, their determination to get rid of him. And unfortunately, and it's a terrible thing to say and to see, they have the same kind of the same people have basically hijacked the appalling hostage dilemma that Israel's facing, hijacked it and used it as a weapon against Netanyahu in the most disgusting, stomach-turning way. So there are a lot of these people. They're on the streets frequently. Their numbers of these demonstrations range between tens of thousands to, at the most, I think, 500,000. These are big demonstrations. Israel, however, is a country, the population is something like 10, now it's about 10 million. We're talking about, overall, a small minority. It's very hard to see it as a small minority because they're so noisy, they're very influential, they tend to be the intelligentsia, the elites, the cultural elites, people who run the media, lawyers. So the impression is given very easily that, you know, Israel is a country that's divided down the middle and it's at its own throat the whole time. Notwithstanding the noisiness and reach of these people that are demonstrating, they are a minority. I would say, rough rule of thumb, I mean, it's my guess, something like 80% of the population is pretty centrist, staunchly behind the war. They may dislike Netanyahu. They may think that he shouldn't have remained in office. Many people think this. He should have resigned on October the 8th and said, I was the prime minister, I presided over this calamity. And he didn't. And people resent that. There's a lot of criticism of his way he's conducted the war. But put that to one side. The vast majority of the Israelis want this war to be continued until Hamas is destroyed and the hostages are returned. And they are staunch in that. The worst thing they can imagine is that Israel will have sacrificed so many of its wonderful young people to this war for nothing if they end the war without it being won, without their objectives having been reached. That's what's motivating the vast majority of people. And the vast majority of people, notwithstanding the terrible divisions between them and the quarrelsome nature of it, again, it's such an amazingly inspiring thing to realize this and to feel this, that notwithstanding all these divisions, ultimately, all these warring tribes in Israel have each other's back. They will die for each other. They are united by the idea, the belief that the cause they are all involved in is the cause of the Jewish people and its continuation, in the nation of Israel. And that includes now an increasing number of Israeli Arabs who have signed up completely to the project of the Jewish nation because they believe in it. They understand what it does for them. They understand that this is the freest and best society they could possibly hope to live in as Arabs. And they are committed to it. And they are fighting alongside Jews and Druze and others in the Israel Defense Forces. Israeli Arabs are fighting and dying alongside them. And this is what people, again, don't really understand in the West. Yes, it's a Jewish country. It's a Jewish nation. It is the fulfillment of Jewish people in the land of Israel. But it's a nation that's made up of many different cultures and ethnicities who pull together. Ultimately, they have each other's back. And this is a fantastically inspiring thing to feel. And it's something, again, that the West just doesn't understand.
Yeah. So what do you feel like, what do you think Prime Minister Netanyahu's political future looks like?
I haven't got the faintest idea. I mean, the man is a political Houdini. You know, he's been written off so many times. He's come back. I don't know. I mean, you know, he's now of a certain age. He's not in the best of health. Who knows? Who knows whether, you know, who knows what's in his mind? I mean, it would seem that, you know, he has set himself certain goals and he wants to fulfill them. What are those goals? To destroy the threat posed by the Islamic Republic of Iran forever, and to produce a regional peace in which the Arab war against Israel would finally be brought to an end through some sort of expansion of the Abraham Accords, some sort of settlement which brings in the Arab world to stop the war, because it's not a war between Israel and the Palestinians. It's a war waged by the Arab world against Israel, in which the Palestinian Arabs have been used as pawns, right, in order to suborn the minds of Western idiots and naive people in the West who don't understand what they're dealing with, and who imagine that this is a war of colonial conquest in which the Palestinian Arabs are the victims and the oppressed. They don't understand, but Netanyahu understands, obviously. This is a war, a 100 years war, waged by the Islamic world against the Jewish homeland.
Yeah.
And Netanyahu, I think, has it in his mind that he can now see a path to ending that war forever. And I think that's what he wants to do. I think he would have to be dragged out kicking and screaming from his role as prime minister before he's achieved both of those aims. But who knows? I mean, you know, I can't tell what's in the man's mind. Israeli politics are so dysfunctional and so bizarre. I couldn't possibly predict how this is going to unfold.
Do you feel like an Israeli strike on Iran is imminent? There's been a little bit of chatter on that in recent days. Is that just speculation?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. I have no idea. I have no way of knowing. Nobody has a way of knowing.
Yeah.
Nobody. I mean, we're getting all this stuff. Who knows? There are so many agendas. You can't believe what you read.
Yeah.
I wouldn't like to say Israel. I mean, Netanyahu said, you know, they're not going to get it. They're not going to get the bomb. We're going to stop it. Well, can they stop it? My understanding, what I read, is that they have the means, if they so wish. They went to war against Iran. They have the means to do terrible damage to the nuclear program, but not to finally eradicate it. Only America can eradicate it. Hmm. And I don't know whether that's true, but that's what I read.
Yeah.
So answer is, I have no idea. I never predict the future. I just look at what I'm seeing, try and understand it, try and analyze it, and explain that as best I can.
Right. How I mentioned earlier, you've written some pretty strong articles in recent months. I mean, what kind of, just on a personal note here before we conclude, what kind of criticism do you face? I guess it'd be mostly just online comments and things of that nature. But do you operate mostly as an independent journalist? I mean, we see your columns appear in a lot of different outlets. So do you feel like that lets you speak a little more freely? But then again, is there any blowback from, you know, organizations or friends or when you do write something that is especially strong?
Well, I've lived in professional and social fire for 3 decades. I worked for 20 years for The Guardian, 10 years of which I was in a kind of internal exile before I finally left them and started working for what they would call right-wing newspapers. I became a freelance. That is to say, I'm an independent operator. And I currently write a weekly column for The Times of London as an independent freelance but under contract to the Times of London and for the Jewish News Syndicate.
Okay.
And I write my blog on my website, MelaniePhillips.substack.com, where I put all my work and I write books. So since the late 1980s, when I started writing op-eds for The Guardian, almost immediately wrote against the governing orthodoxies of the day, I have been, cancelled. I was cancelled long before the word was invented, blacklisted by major publishing houses in Britain. Certainly, I lost all the friends that I had on the left. And I now have new friends and new colleagues. And so I go on. But those of us who fight against the prevailing orthodoxies, who write against the grain like this, and there are a few of us in Britain, in America, elsewhere, we all basically face the same kinds of pressures, which are pretty intense. And we rely on one thing alone, which is that there are millions and millions of people, ordinary, decent, sane people among the general public who really do get it, who may not think deeply about stuff that could going on. They're preoccupied, obviously, by their own lives, what's really important in their lives, their families, their work, so on. But they get it. They understand what's at stake instinctively, and they're with us. Yeah. And they tell us that they're with us. And speaking for myself, I have drawn not just comfort and consolation, but it's been what's kept me going all these years. Because as much as the intelligentsia, the left, the people who run the newspapers, run broadcasting, run the cultural life of the country, as much as they vilify me in social media or whatever they do, I know that, there are countless numbers of people who are cheering me on, and that has kept me going.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the book many years ago? You talked about your history at The Guardian and then getting out of that and becoming more independent. Mm-hmm. Was it Guardian Angel or?
Yeah, I wrote a small political and personal memoir, which was published in 2018.
Okay.
Called Guardian Angel. I think the subtitle was My Journey from Leftism to Sanity.
Yeah, that's a great book, by the way. And this is your latest, The Builder's Stone. We can just give this a plug here at the end. Maybe you can tell our viewers how they can go about, I assume it's through all the traditional means to order books, Amazon and such, but is there a particular outlet you'd like to point them to?
It's Amazon. It's not, you won't find it in bookshops.
Okay.
Because it's published through a means called print on demand, which means that it's published when you buy the book on Amazon. When you click buy,
okay,
they publish the book.
Okay,
so that's how you get it.
So is that through a U.S. publisher or British or
Amazon.com for U.S. I mean, in Britain, Amazon.co.uk. In Australia, it's the Australian version of Amazon. It's your national Amazon outlet.
Okay. So but the publishing house, did you just kind of go through this yourself as an independent author?
No. It's published in America by Wicked Sun.
Okay.
Which is a publisher based in New York.
Yeah. And then you mentioned your Substack page. Any other social media accounts that our viewers could be made aware of?
No, my Substack page is where it's at. I mean, I'm on Twitter, but I don't use it very much. I use it mainly to advertise what I'm writing.
Okay.
It's my Substack page, which is the one that people should go to, melaniephillips.substack.com.
Okay. And then how much longer does your U.S. book tour go?
About 2 days.
Oh, and then
I will have been here about 3 weeks.
Okay. And are you going to be back in Israel or the U.K.?
Yes, I'm going back to Israel I'm due to arrive back there on Thursday evening.
Okay, just letting you know, we've got our very campus here produces this wonderful Irish dance show called Celtic Throne. They're actually touring in Israel in 2 weeks, 2 shows in Tel Aviv, Beersheba, Haifa, and Jerusalem. So So I'll have Sam, the producer, contact you and see if we can get you some tickets for the Jerusalem show. I forget the exact date that it's on, but you'll love it. And I think the very first show in Tel Aviv is very nearly sold out. So
it
sounds like it's going to be a fantastic tour for our young people here on campus. And maybe we'll have a chance to see you again in passing in Jerusalem. Melanie Phillips.
I hope we'll meet again somewhere, rather.
For sure. Thank you for joining us on The Trumpet Daily.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.